these folks, by and large, have a lot of life complexity, and these things get on top of us. Companies who supply these sorts of boring, recurring services, so I'm talking about energy companies, insurance providers, and so on, they make an awful lot of money out of our distraction.
Welcome to Tech Talks, hosted by myself, David Savage, and powered by Nash Squared. On today's show, my guest is Greg. He is the CEO and co-founder of Naus, a company that are helping you save money on your household bills through the use of AI. But joining me before that, as co-host for the day, one of my American colleagues, Brenna, all the way from Texas. How are you?
Great. How are you? First off, I'm excited to figure out how I can save some money from Greg. So that's great. But all good here in the States.
Yeah, I imagine household bills are coming down quite dramatically for you because, well, it's not like you need the heating right now.
Yes, I'm in Texas and we are loving our cool summer at 80 degrees. I don't know what that is in Celsius, but for us, that is like, whoo, I could still wear a sweatshirt in 80 degrees.
80. Oh no, 80's hot. I think 80's pretty hot. 80, in British terms, that's a pretty good summer's day. I mean, I suppose I'm being very naive because I'm like, well, you don't need your heating, but you will need air conditioning. And I suppose running air conditioning is really quite expensive.
It is, but it's just kind of a way of life here. You could go into a store and, like, I know when I've had friends over and we go to stores and stuff, they're always very concerned about getting sick because of how much air con there is everywhere.
Yeah, that's true. I've never really thought about it because, like, I worry about it on planes. You know, oh, and you might get sick on the plane because of aircon and recycled air. But yeah, if you're living in it constantly, I mean, I'll admit that when I go to somewhere like Vegas, a week of aircon, and I am like, I've had enough.
Okay, Vegas is a different scenario too, though. not the best of the states. Now, some people might disagree with me, but
a lot of aircon, of aircon.
Yes, it is a lot of AC and like a lot of also smoke, tanning smell. So there's a lot of other variables that make it where you're like, oh, I could get sick.
Yeah, yeah. Well, look, we'll hand over to the interview with Greg because this is very much about using AI to find the best deals, switch providers, look at your patterns and your usage and basically pull all of those bills together. And it's almost like having a co-pilot for running your household bills, which I think is very interesting and will relates to a little bit of a conversation that we're going to have about an event that we've got coming up in Edinburgh in May afterwards. So we'll hand over to Greg, and then myself and Brenna will be back afterwards. Today, I'm joined by Greg. Greg, you're the CEO and co-founder at Naus. How are you today?
I'm well, thank you.
Whereabouts are you joining us from?
Here in central London in Clerkenwell.
Ah, know it very well. It's a lovely part of town.
It is. On nicer days than this, it's a lot nicer than this. But yeah, we'll survive in the rain on a slightly drizzly Tuesday morning in London.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And let's be honest, this time of year, we're not expecting it to be amazing weather. So I suppose we can't be too grumbly about the weather at the moment. Anyway, that aside, you're there and you're leading Naus. Before we get into anything else, do you want to tell us a little bit about who or what Naus is?
Naus is an AI for your household bills. We save people money on everything from energy to broadband to mobile phones, and we do it in a couple of ways. The first is that we do it for you. And this is one of those things which we don't always tend to do terribly well for ourselves. We often forget to renew in time or let something slip and the pennies add up. Before you know it, it's a few hundred quid a year. On average, we save households about £500 a year just by taking responsibility for keeping on top of all this stuff for them. And the other thing we do is because the way we do it is, you can think about it as a co-pilot for your household finance, because we do it for you rather than on behalf of the suppliers of these things, when and if we get paid commissions for changing your provider of energy or such like, there's often rewards in place and those go to our members. So our members typically save quite a lot, both directly and indirectly through our service.
If you don't mind me asking then, who is this aimed at? Because obviously everyone has household bills, but there are certain sections of society, I imagine, where the cost of living crisis is biting harder than most, and it might be difficult to know exactly where those people can save money. Are you aiming it at a particular demographic, or is this very much for everyone?
So it's, look, there's, Yes, at one level, everyone, but particularly of relevance is folks who have a bit of life complexity. What I mean by that, it usually happens, you know, a couple of years after you've moved into your new house and got a couple of kids, or, you know, maybe it's just a dog. But one way or other, the number of things you're managing in your life starts increasing. It's not just, you know, the energy bills and the water rates. It's also your mobile phone bill. Maybe it's a kid's mobile phone bill. It's pet insurance. It's home insurance. It's your mortgage. And staying on top of your refinancing plan for that. By the time you've got, you know, a couple of kids and a car in the garage outside, and we're talking not about, you know, the 1%. We're talking about sort of middle England, midlife, and typically middle-aged, right? These folks, by and large, have a lot of life complexity, and these things get on top of us. Now, companies who supply these sorts of boring, recurring services, so I'm talking about energy companies, insurance providers, and so on, they make an awful lot of money out of our distraction. You could be really cynical and say they're doing it on purpose. They deliberately design their services to make it easy to forget to renew on time or double check that you're getting a good deal. In a way, the easier we've made paying for these things, things like direct debit, 2/3 of UK households pay for their bills by DD. Because it's so easy to pay automatically at the end of each month, we don't really notice how much we're paying. And so when your mobile phone bill goes up by inflation plus 4%, or when you come off your handset only, your handset contract and roll onto a connection only contract, or when your broadband company doesn't tell you about the introductory offer that your next door neighbor's just bought, you don't notice it. And one thing becomes another. It's only a quid there or a quid there a month. And before you know it, it's not a pound or two a month. It's actually, for an average household, about £1,000 a year of this sort of loyalty penalty. So a service like Nous, essentially, if you had a personal assistant or had someone to manage this stuff for you, then they'd have stayed on top of all this. But who has one of them? And along comes this wonderful class of technology, AI, and the idea basically that very inexpensively, I can get a computer, set of computer systems, to look over my shoulder and keep on top of this stuff for me. And hence a service like Nous is born.
And in terms of kind of share, because this is personal financial data, I suppose there is one question mark, which would be if AI is being involved, and that's a hell of a lot of data and some quite sensitive data, perhaps around people's personal finances. I suppose you at the same time really have to make sure that you are reassuring your customers that the service is secure, robust, and that they can trust it at the same time.
And there's a couple of layers to that. The first and simplest is, who are we working for? Cui bono, right? Who benefits here? Now, when you lend your data to Google, or when you lend your data to Meta, they are selling that information to advertisers. The entire basis for their commercial operation, the reason they'll give you a Gmail account for free or let you use Facebook without charging, is because you are the product. And your information in packages or subject to GDPR regulations is being sold to advertisers. When we conceived of Nous, one of the foundational principles of the business was we knew we wanted to work for the household rather than for the suppliers of these services. So this is a fundamental point of difference from, let's say, a price comparison site in the UK. We've got Compare the Markets and Money Supermarket. And, you know, most countries have these kinds of national champion price comparison services, all of which are working for the advertisers. Now, they purport to be giving you the chance to get a good cheap deal. And sometimes for people who are really on it and do their homework, you do get a cheap deal. But fundamentally, when you use one of those services, you are a lead and your qualified interest is being sold to the highest bidder to try to persuade you to switch to a new mobile phone company or a new insurance provider. Nous is a subscription service. Now, we'll start out by offering our subscription for a few months for free because we'd like to get you comfortable with the idea that we can actually save you a lot of money. And generally speaking, very few of us are great at this. And if you do trust the computer and the computer can do it better than we can, well, maybe we'll let the computer keep doing it. But after we got you comfortable on that journey, yeah, we're going to charge. We're going to charge a modest amount per month, a few quid a month. It's not an expensive service for us to offer once we're offering it at volume and scale. But for that few quid a month, what you get as a user is cast iron confidence that we work for you. So our job is not to sell your data. We're not an advertising business. You are trusting us with first-party data. We access lots of second-party and third-party data. One of the things you can do, if you want to, as a convenience, when you connect to our service, is you can connect an open banking account, for instance. So we can get access to information about how much you're paying for your energy or how much you're paying for your broadband. If you don't want to do that, you don't have to. You can just tell us that information. You could upload a bill and we'll scan it for you. We'll talk about AI, I'm sure, and how integral to our service that is. Or you can connect an inbox. And if you do that, then we'll forward emails from just the white list of suppliers, energy suppliers, broadband suppliers, and so on. Suck that sort of the bills from those companies in, read them for you, and get the relevant information into your account. Now, you don't have to have us do that. You could tell us whatever information you're comfortable telling us. But clearly, the more information you're comfortable sharing, the more that we can help you save money on these things. Our job is not to make money by selling you stuff. Our job is to provide a service which is convenient.
And how far does this extend, sorry? Because if you look at the How It Began section of your website, yeah, it talks about the fact that your wife was expecting your second child. You didn't have time to spend lots of time on hold with British Gas. And before you know it, you'd been accidentally moved onto a more expensive energy tariff. I assume that is something that a lot of people can relate to. Where does the AI then hand back over? Because I assume, for example, that the AI is not then going to be able to interface with various different firms and manage the whole end-to-end process for you. Does the customer have to step back in to actually complete that process once a recommendation has been made? Or,
well, I mean, to a very limited extent, and only insofar as it's strictly necessary. Our whole proposition is we'll do it for you. We can't do everything for you. There are certain things that you have to do for yourself, including approving staff and signing staff off, subject, you know, to being comfortable with our recommendations. A very practical example: if you want to change your mobile phone provider, let's say you're switching from a contract you bought 18 months ago, which is with a new handset, we can now find you a SIM-only deal, which will save you 20 quid a month. That's a very typical savings possible if you've bought a handset contract and that handset contract has expired. At a certain point in that process, you're going to have to send a text message from your phone to ask for a PAC code. If you don't do that, then you won't port your number over from your old supplier to your new supplier. There's not very much more that you need to do as a consumer. If you've authorized us to act as your agent, we can get on with pretty much everything else. But that step is one that you'll have to take. Our job here is essentially to be a co-pilot. It's to remind you to do it, to help you do it, make it convenient for you to do it. Once you get the relevant code, tell us what it is and we'll handle the rest. So for an awful lot of this, where there are user steps, the reason we humans don't tend to do these things in an organized and well-prepared way is not because they're very hard, but because they're just another of the things on our back in life, another of the monkeys on your back. So the purpose, the insight behind Nous, if you want, is not that this is hard, but it's work and it's distracting. And at the end of a busy week, when you've finally got the kids to bed, you know, you don't want to sit there and sort your mobile phone contract out. What you want to do is, you know, relax with a beer and a Netflix. And that's the reality. And companies know that. They take advantage of our distraction, our disengagement, and they prey on it. So yes, you're right. I mean, the story of Nous very simply came back to that personal experience I had. I was, as we all are, a customer of energy services, and I was moved without really paying attention to it. And the amounts of money were a little bit painful. I wouldn't say it was a life-changing sum, but it was enough that it really got me going. And at that point in my life, you know, I had time. I was between businesses. I'd sold my previous company. I had time on my hands to get on top of this. And I got on top of it, and there was a real sense of kind of roar of outrage from somewhere sort of deep in the heart of my being. I just thought, this is wrong. These guys are basically taking the mickey, and they're getting away with it. And they're getting away with it because very few of us actually do get on top of this stuff. About one in six households, as it happens, about one in six UK households, based on our now fairly extensive research, have at least one adult who is what we call a bill nerd. Now, if you are a bill nerd, you will not worry about this stuff because you are on it. You not only do you get the Martin Lewis MSE, that's the, you know, the UK money saving champion expert. Not only do you get Martin Lewis's newsletter every week, but you actually read it. You take pride at being on the best mobile phone contract and having price shopped your mobile phone bills and price shopped your car insurance and make sure you know what's happening in the energy market. Well done. If that is you and you've got a spreadsheet, you do not need Nous.
Sorry, just to interrupt. Did you say one in six in each household or one in six in the general population?
One in six households have a bull right. nerd in them. And if you live in that household, your partner or you is on this. Well done. Nouse is not for you. Our product is for everyone else. And those people who do not take pride in this, who aren't interested in it, the average person thinks about, I don't know, energy for 6 minutes a year. You don't stop and think about whether you're currently on the best tariff, and so you probably aren't. And if you do stop and think about it, you have to go and search, you have to go and research and understand what's currently happening to pricing, as pricing floating at the moment, should you get a fixed price deal or not? I mean, life's too short. And companies know that. And they design their communication so that we don't read them. Did you know this? Mobile phone companies are obliged by Ofcom, the UK sectoral regulator, to send a message every month before you pay your bill. Every single one of the major mobile phone companies, the major carriers, has invested time and energy in studying exactly at what time of the week and exactly how long that message should be. So they are technically compliant, but as few people as possible actually pay attention to it. Now, you might think, surely this is the height of cynicism. This is what profit maximization means if you are a provider of a mobile phone service. So effectively, these companies are hacking our distraction. That's how they make their money. And that's why there is an opportunity for a business like Nouse, which works for you. It's as simple as that. And it would have been possible to build this business 10 years ago. The problem with this business 10 years ago is you'd have had to have humans at every step of it. You touch on privacy. I mean, personally, I feel much more comfortable trusting an anonymous AI where I know that someone designed this to work for me and is not trying to sell my data through the back door than I would to trust a human to look over the shoulder at my information, especially if I never met them. So I don't know. I mean, I think horses for courses here, but we think this is a fantastic application of how modern automation, AI and co-pilot systems can dramatically reduce people's inconvenience. They can improve quality of life. They can reduce your stress and they can save you a staggeringly large amount of money. I say the average number for a UK household of cumulative overpayments. We're not talking about a rich household. I'm talking about a household on an average UK combined household median income, about £45,000 total household income. It's about £1,000 a year that household is overpaying for its services because they are not on top of this stuff. That's an average number. We've seen households who are literally overpaying by £3,000.
Yeah, I can. Well, I mean, my brother-in-law is the tariff nerd. My wife and I are not. My motor insurance went up last year because I changed car and I just couldn't be bothered to. Maybe it was laziness. So we very much fall into that category where we're probably overpaying for stuff because other stuff just seems more important, which is kind of mad when it's money, but I suppose to your point, they are preying on that kind of mindset. You mentioned selling your previous business. People might be familiar with One Fine Stay and the story there, but I would love to just ask you very quickly, having successfully exited one business as a founder, what have you carried from that experience into this, and what have you decided to leave by the wayside and decide actually no, that's not going to be the right way to build this second company?
One Fine Stay certainly was at the time we sold it an operations business more than anything. So we managed something in the order of about sort of £4-5 billion of very beautiful properties around the world in major cities. And we made them available for short periods of time when their owners were away to guests staying. You can think about it as a sort of managed experience Airbnb type product, but at the luxury price point end of the industry. And I started that business having previously worked as an investor at a venture capital firm in London, Index Ventures. So I'd seen an awful lot of entrepreneurs and met an awful lot of startups over the course of my investing career. And I was itchy. I wanted to build something and I was impatient to get started on it. And the idea for One Fine Stay came together. It was a sort of a moment after I had this holiday in Italy and I'd had a very miserable accommodation experience. And then I was walking into work, literally walking past all these beautiful houses in the center of London. They were all empty and the lights weren't on. I was suddenly struck by this thought, why is it that the nicest parts of the nicest cities are the ones where people are least likely to be living all year round? And if you could stay anywhere, that's where you choose to stay. But they're also the ones that aren't available. This was before Airbnb had its sort of ubiquity that it does today. And so putting one and one together got three, and thought, well, what's missing is a service in the middle to make that convenient and simple. So we started building OnePoint today, and I'd say with a surfeit of urgency, underpinned by or animated by a degree of anxiety almost, this terror about what if we don't find product market fit? What if people don't want, you know, you make the dog food, what if the dogs don't want to eat it? The moment, I can vividly remember it in 2010, about a year off, a bit less actually, about 9 months after I quit my well-paid, comfy job as a venture capital investor to start this crazy thing. In 2010, about 9 months after I quit, we just got that first intimation that maybe we can sell this. Maybe there's product market fit here, that we put advertising up and people seem to want to buy room nights in these nice central London properties at a price that made sense, and the marketing machine seemed to work. And without pausing for breath, we just ran at it. Head down, chased scale. And there's something to be said for that, right? Momentum is a drug. It helps you build a culture around that. It helps you organize a business around that. Goodness knows it impresses venture capital investors. And I was scared more than anything. I was animated by fear that what happened if we didn't make product market fit? What happens if we couldn't raise enough money to go build the business? Well, we did. We raised our first investment round actually from my former firm Index Ventures. Then we raised in total, you know, many, many tens of millions more over the course of the next several years. And we scaled. We scaled in London. We scaled in New York. We scaled in Paris and about a dozen other international cities. Sold the business fairly successfully in 2016 for about $250 million to a French hotel company, Accor Hotels. The consequence, to answer your question, the consequence of having been animated more than anything by fear was that we started scaling that business despite its monumental operational complexity. I've not dwelt on that, but we were managing thousands and thousands of properties, luxury properties, every single one of them different from every other one. We were managing linen, we were managing fleets, we were managing dispatch, we were managing guest services, host services. It was an unbelievably operationally intense business. I had 700 people in the company by the time we sold it, to give you a sense. And all that complexity, a good portion of that complexity existed, not because it had to exist, but because that was just the way we happened to have started the organization. Now, complexity is good if it builds a moat, but complexity is bad if you're trying to scale fast. And the operational intensity, sophistication of that business, it was numbing. It was grueling. And as an entrepreneur building that business, I can strongly personally attest how the cumulative stress of that, particularly, I was traveling constantly. It was a travel business at its heart. We're managing a very large and dispersed team, multi-locally situated, with a huge amount of operational intensity and complexity, input variability, all sorts of other complexifying factors. Nats. It's, you know, reflecting on that experience, I had several years after that sale to reflect on that experience. We had the intimations of product market fit quite early. We have very deliberately paced ourselves. We didn't chase it. We could, we will. But what I wanted to do first was deeply answer the question, how do you scale a business of this class with this intrinsic complexity? How do you build the automation capability? How do you have the capacity? Not just a 10 exit, but a 100 exit before you start just throwing people at the problem. And so I think I've reflected a lot on that One Fine Stay learning experience and sought to build a business not only that is fundamentally more accommodating of scale, but also that we've prepared and culturally adapted to being able to scale it before we just throw money onto the proverbial bonfire.
It's interesting because obviously growth and scaling a business is so intrinsically part of kind of startup founder culture. And yet the advice would appear to be take your time, put the foundations in place. And perhaps with technology and automation where it is now today, it allows you that a little bit more breathing space to think about how you do that and then have tools that allow you to scale in a seriously major way a bit further down the line.
Yes. And I'd also say you need to know your business. Now, if you're doing is you're copying, fast copying someone else's model, if it's a well-understood execution pattern, you don't need to over-worry this, right? If you're building a SaaS business and the product works, you're not going to have to worry about scalability. It's bits and bytes in a sales organization. However, if you're in a complex operations business, my goodness me, the moment you start scaling, your problems multiply. They don't divide. So I've invested in a bunch of complex operations businesses. I was an angel investor in Deliveroo. I mean, One Fine Stay was this complex operations business. And for that class of business, I mean, thankfully, Nous is a much higher margin operating business. But for that class of problem, you've got to understand, deeply understand your unit economics and your scale operations before you start just buying volume. It's very easy to buy volume in a very large market like the one that we're in. Buy that too soon, and you end up spending all of the limited mental capacity and blood flow and cultural energy in an organization grappling with the consequences of that, rather than spending your time and energy really deeply understanding who the customer is, how you can reach them cost effectively, how you can delight them. I mean, we finally launched in beta late last year. We turned on our sort of net promoter score machine in November time. We're getting comfortably kind of ticking around the plus 70, plus 69, plus 72 level. That tells me fundamentally that we're achieving real customer delight. We're really hitting a deep need, and we're servicing people to a high level of quality. That is important. So I want to keep that. I want to keep that quality level high as we then start, as we now have been, automating and building the capacity to 10x it and then 10x it again.
One final quick fire question to finish on then. What question do you find yourself asking your peer group?
Would you believe it? Quite often, the conversation I end up having with other entrepreneurs is not a conversation about the business they're currently running. It's a conversation about how they are coping with the challenges of running a business. Know yourself, not only understand the business you're in, how to scale it, but also surviving, coping, adapting to the near constant stress load of the entrepreneurial journey. I think the ability to do that, to have resilience, to have survival and coping mechanisms around you and personal life strategies to make to cope with the lows, which are low, I think that is the hard bit of the entrepreneurial journey and which doesn't get talked about enough. So the conversation I often end up having with other entrepreneurs is, how are you doing? And really, how are you doing? And then the other thing that entrepreneurs always talk about when they talk to other entrepreneurs behind closed doors is we talk about hiring and how unbelievably hard it is to find really, really good people. But, we all know that.
Well, look, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you. Thank you very much for your time today. And good luck scaling Nous when you do really go for it, even more so than you are now.
Thanks very much, David. Thanks for having me on the show today.
So, Brett, Greg talks about a kind of a co-pilot for your household bills. I've seen increasingly a lot of people talk about AI as kind of like being a co-pilot for life. And it's a theme that is picked up upon in the next version of our TechFlix documentary series, where we have focused on AI and robotics. And Ott Velsberg, who is the Estonian government chief data officer, he very much believes that AI will almost be like each individual's personal assistant. So I suppose Nous are just an early adopter or at the vanguard of this, but it's gonna get a lot broader, and we're gonna end up having kind of AI assistants very much helping us with all sorts of things beyond just household bills.
Yeah, I mean we see it in our everyday everything. That there's an article that came out that you actually shared with me. Where he's Meta Nick Clegg.
Nick Clegg, yes. Yeah. So very familiar to British listeners, probably less so to American listeners or North American listeners.
Yes, but I liked what he said about using it as a sword versus a shield to like cut through things and making it, I almost see it as a tool versus a hindrance, but everyone's different in how they view it. I mean, I use it now, like anything with our house. Honestly, someone has an app that will send text message. It's automated. It's all done, and they'll schedule it. There's no people interaction, and to me, I'm also somebody who's an adopter of it. But I think it allows us to be more human.
Yeah.
Because we're not bogged down with the, okay, let me schedule this. Let me get a script together and say these exact words to you to make sure that we get all of the checklist things done. Mm. Whereas now we see it where, you and I can have a conversation on Teams and record it, and we'll get an email that recaps, what we all said we were going to do. And, we can kind of just throw our hands up and not take notes on a piece of paper or, you know, in an email, and we can be very present in the conversation.
Are you using AI in our working environment yet on a regular basis? Because funnily enough, next week I'm in Rio for Web Summit Rio. One of the talks that I'm moderating is a marketing talk. And listeners, Brenna is our North American marketing lead. It's a marketing talk about how AI is changing the role of marketeers and how it's helping them. In one instance, one of our guests on stage is going to be talking about them getting hyper local and really understanding the local needs of users. I just wondered, is it something that you're progressively using in work?
Yes and no. I mean, it is. Go back to the sword. It's a double-edged sword. And that is not the comparison he made, but it's one of those things that it's a fine line of, you know, you need to use it, and companies, I feel like they need to be smart about what they roll out, because people are going to just, let me log into ChatGPT and go in and make it easy and do it that way. But, you know, you have to be aware of like what information you're putting out there, because of course it can be used elsewhere because it's learning. So I do use it to revise and update and think. I think the best way, I don't remember who said it, and I hate that I'm not giving credit to somebody, but, AI right now is like an intern. You almost have to train it, tell it what to do. So I treat it in that sense of let's do some refinement, let's do some review copy, that kind of stuff. But it's not at the stage where, at least myself, I know I'll get there where I feel full confidence that it's like, yes, run with this, create all of the campaign outline or the collateral or whatever it is. But there still needs to be some element of human touch. I mean,
Yeah,
I don't know how you feel about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because Elon Musk was in the news, I think, either today or yesterday, talking about the fact that he thought that AI would be brighter than the most advanced superhuman even by next year, which is interesting because that's in contrast to Nick Clegg getting up on stage in London yesterday. So this was Thursday morning, the 11th. This is obviously going out, this podcast, on Friday the 12th. He got up on stage yesterday talking about the fact that AI is not a major threat to global democracy, because this year there is a stupid amount of elections going on this year. Yeah. I think it's the most amount of elections in history. We've got the general election here in the UK. Obviously, we've got the general election in the US. I think it was the Korean election yesterday. We've just had the Russian election. There are elections everywhere right now. And obviously, Brenna, you're not overly familiar with Nick Clegg. Nick Clegg is the former Deputy Prime Minister of the UK. He was leader of the Liberal Democrats. So, you know, he's a pretty senior politician. He was a pretty senior politician before he went to Meta. And so therefore you kind of go, all right, well, if he speaks about democracy and the impact of AI, well, Meta obviously are hoping that he's got some credibility there. But it is really interesting the way he's talking about it. And it's interesting because there is this wave of AI coming out over the summer. Lots of the next iterations of ChatGPT and the like from OpenAI and Meta have got, I think Meta are calling it Llama 3, is set to launch. Microsoft have got the next version or iteration of their AI coming out. And there is a definite distinction between kind of Microsoft and Meta in that Meta are going open source. And yes, Microsoft and a few of the other big tech players are not. And it's kind of which do people think is better, you know? And there are competing voices on either side. Some say that open source is more risky because those tools could be taken and used, obviously, by anybody. But equally, the other flip side of that is, well, it's more eyes on it. And if it's not a closed house, then more eyes can spot the vulnerabilities quicker and make it safer. So it's a really interesting time where AI is concerned.
Yeah, no, I'd agree. It almost makes me, if you've ever heard, it takes a village, the way that they're pitching it or positioning it as, you know, almost like almost like a Wikipedia where, you know, we have so many people that can,
yeah, exactly,
can contribute and say whether this is fake or not. But I think the part that they've taken the stance of, from my understanding, is trying to label that it's AI generated versus just a full strike through removing. I mean, of course, there's different penalties and things like that they take, but I'd be interested to hear Like if they're what you hear from Web Summit Rio and what everyone's saying, because I'm in that school of like, I don't think we know. We're in a little bit of the Wild West of, is it best to have open source where people can contribute? But you also have that, you know, double-edged sword of, well, they can take it and use it for not so great things, or just have it closed. And then if it's closed, we're trusting a very niche group of individuals and companies. And that brings a whole nother set of issues of, you know, monopolies. Is it the right bias? What are the things, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's a wild one because each AI model, I think, they're trained based off who's training them and what information. So it does, you do tend to, when you think about it, lean towards the open, because if it's trained to a specific bias, then it's, you know, is it trustworthy, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And I think in the article, they quote Nick Clegg as saying today, you know, you'll get many more eyes on potential flaws, to your point, it takes a village, rather than relying on one corporate entity playing whack-a-mole with their own systems. And I think that's a, you know, obviously he's gonna position Meta's philosophy positively, but you kind of sit there and go, well, I can understand that point of view. Look, this is a super complicated, interesting topic, which is why we've decided to make a film about this. Nothing like, you know, trying to take a bite out of it, and hopefully we score a home run and don't miss. But if you are in Edinburgh on the 23rd of May, we're going to be premiering this film at the National Robotarium. So if you're in Northern England or Scotland, perhaps you could make it along. It's on Eventbrite. We'll put a link to that event in the show notes. And Brenna, you're making the trip too.
For sure. Wouldn't miss it.
You've been to the UK plenty of times, but you've never been to Edinburgh.
Never been. No. So I'm relying heavily on my UK colleagues to give me some insights, things that obviously I'm there for the event and I'll probably be in Edinburgh less than 24 hours. But yeah, I'm just excited to talk to a number of people and get their perspectives on AI, but also just see Edinburgh as well, selfishly.
See the castle, see the Royal Mile, see George Street.
You know, I got to do a little research for sure. But yeah, all of those fun things. I think it's nowhere near the Loch Ness Monster, but that is like my thing that I've always wanted to see when I go up north. So
no, Inverness is quite a lot further on than Edinburgh. I mean, maybe not in American, in US terms, where, you know, your geography is warped compared to ours, or maybe ours is just small-minded. But the problem that you've got is that once you get north of the border, there's fairly limited roads and infrastructure. So getting up to Inverness is a bit of a trek from Edinburgh.
But I'm sure it's worth it.
I'm sure. I've got to be honest. I've not been up to Loch Ness. So,
It says it takes only 3.5 hour drive. That's nothing.
From Edinburgh.
Yeah.
I mean, that's fairly long drive. I mean, say that to a Brit and they're like, whew.
That's a trip to the beach where we would just jump in the car, go, and then be there. Like, well, there that's not there a deal. Yeah.
Need AI but maybe to plan it in your car.
Yeah, we're just, we see travel differently in the States. Three hours is nothing.
There's that bias. Anyway, look, Brenna, thank you for joining us on today's show. We will be back on Monday. Tech Talks is hosted and edited by David Savage. It is produced by Nash Squared. And we have special thanks to Lemzy for supplying music to this show.